Case number 12-1071 et al. Camelot Terrace, Inc. et al. Petitioners v. National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Landau for the petitioners, Ms. Sheehy, respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Chris Landau, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case turns on the simple and settled point that administrative agencies have only those powers granted to them by statute. Those powers may be explicit or implicit, but unless they're in the statute, the agency doesn't have them.
Let me ask you, you argue that there's no difference between litigation costs and bargaining costs. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. We don't say there's no difference. We say that there is a spectrum where litigation...
Should I pull out your brief?
Say what we say is litigation bargaining costs are akin to litigation costs on the spectrum that has litigation costs clearly not recoverable on one end of the spectrum and... reinstatement with or without back pay on the other end of the spectrum, which is clearly a substantive remedy. Our position, Your Honor, is that bargaining costs are, like litigation, the costs that you have to incur to try to get the substantive remedy, not the substantive remedy in and of itself. So to the extent we suggested in our brief that they are indistinguishable or absolutely identical...
You're qualifying that.
I'm qualifying that today, yes. To say,
because we have already held, as you know, in Fallbrook, that bargaining expenses was a reasonable interpretation.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And let me qualify what I'm about to say again. Your Honor just said the word we have held in Fallbrook. As we said in our recent 28J letter last week, we think that that was not a holding in Fallbrook, that the issue presented in Fallbrook and the way the decision is written says the only issue here is whether the board abused its discretion in applying its standard and that there was no challenge there to the authority issue. If your honors believe that you crossed that bridge in Fallbrook, then I'll have to live with that, but we just wanted to point out that we think that that is an over-reading of Fallbrook and that Fallbrook falls more naturally into the unbelievable mold where the issue, in unbelievable, they did enforce an award of negotiating fees because that had not been challenged. And again, I think this is the first case to present a square challenge to the authority issue on bargaining costs.
I agree with you, because Fallbrook, I looked and looked for any cite to any time we had said bargaining costs were awardable, and the only cites are to the board, and that would be fine if we'd gone ahead to say, and we agree, or and we affirm, or something like that. It'd be just like noting that the district court held such and such and stopping there. I think at most it's a sub silential holding, which is not favored. So,
again, I think bargaining costs, certainly the authority issue for bargaining costs, is still a live issue in this court, unless you want to go to a regime where overly broad language can be characterized as a holding. Again, though, let's start here with the litigation costs, because I think the litigation costs are just squarely in the face of this court's.
Okay, we're talking about attorney's fees, right?
Yes, exactly.
I want to get language straight.
Yes, exactly. All right. So attorney's fees.
Yes.
We think that their assertion that they can invoke, the board's assertion of inherent authority, which is the only basis on which they are basing their award shifting attorney's fees, is inherent authority, that is not only incorrect, but truly radical in administrative law. One can certainly agree or disagree with the extent to which Congress gives a particular authority to the board. And there are plenty of cases where this court and others have held that general rulemaking authority carries with it certain implicit grants of power. The point is, and this court held this in Unbelievable, that but precisely because fee shifting is such an exception to our general rule, it cannot be fit into that rubric of implicit authority. So in unbelievable...
That's a slight overstatement of unbelievable.
Yes.
Well, you know, it seemed to me there's the footnote two, is it?
Yeah.
Leaves it open.
Again, what I was saying, Your Honor, I mean to be very clear, and I apologize if I was not. Unbelievable resolves the statutory authority issue, both explicit and implicit statutory authority. It leaves open the question of inherent authority. The footnote star says we are not deciding. The dissent in that case suggested that there might be inherent authority, and the majority in Unbelievable said the board order before us relied solely on its statutory authority. So we have no reason to address the inherent authority issue that the dissent is getting into. So, and I apologize if I just misspoke a moment ago. What I was saying is the Unbelievable court clearly said there was no statutory authority, but it reserved in the footnote that Your Honor mentioned the question of inherent authority. And our basic point here is that as a matter of administrative law 101, there is no such thing as inherent authority for an administrative agency the way an Article III court may have inherent authority. To be sure, this court and others have sometimes used the phrase inherent authority. But if you look at each one of those cases, they're always talking about implicit statutory authority. They're looking at...
Well, we have said it wasn't ultra vires.
This court in the Alwyn case, again, the issue came up about litigation costs, and there had been no objection. You had almost probably the same colloquy that you had today. And all this court said is it's not obviously ultra vires. That hardly means that it's correct or that they have it. And so Judge Wald, who was the author of the dissent in Unbelievable, speaking for the court in Alwyn, just said in a footnote in Alwyn, you know, this was not properly raised here, and we don't have to get to the extraordinary circumstances exception under 10E because it's not obviously ultra vires. This case is the first case where this court is squarely presented with the issue whether or not the board has inherent authority, separate and independent from statute. And our proposition to you today is that that would be truly revolutionary in administrative law.
Yeah, but
revolutionary.
It doesn't. I mean, let's assume, arguendo, yeah, that the talk of inherent authority in a congressionally created agency is an oxymoron. But does Unbelievable exhaust all the possible inferences of a grant of authority from the statute?
Well, Your Honor, it certainly does under 10C.
Right.
And what I would say to you in response to that question is that the board in this case did not purport to point to some other implicit source of statutory authority. In other words, it didn't say, here's our general rules and regulations provision. The board in this case specifically relied on inherent authority akin to the inherent authority of the Article III courts. So from a Chenery point of view, that is the issue you have here before you. This would be a different case if the board had gone off and found some other source of statutory authority that wasn't covered in Unbelievable.
What I want to be clear about is when the board says it's our inherent authority and then it talks about we're acting to sort of control our proceedings and the integrity and efficiency and mm-hmm. effectiveness of our proceedings. My question is that a sufficient enough reference? Because I think it was one of our judges in a dissenting opinion who said that, you know, to talk about inherent authority in the administrative context is incorrect. It's a question of whether or not you can infer it from the statutory grant.
Right.
So the board, in talking about, you know, we do have authority to control our proceedings, to control those who come before us, that type of thing. Do you think that's enough of an invocation, or does the board have to cite, you know, Section 10Q or something?
Your Honor, you know, I think that's a hard question to answer in the abstract.
Again, no, I'm asking it in the context of this case.
I think they did. They clearly did not. In the specific context of this case, I think it is crystal clear, if you look at the board's opinion, they're citing Chambers versus NASCO. They're citing the entire line of Article III cases involving the bad case shifting as an inherent sanction outside of Rule 11 and everything else. There is not one word in the board's decision here that says anything about any other statutory source of authority.
No, I agree. They don't cite 10Q, but they're talking about, I'm just asking, this is a question.
Sure.
Is it sufficient that they're saying we do have authority to control the proceedings before us, and when a party comes before us and acts in the manner of this party, we can say there, we can try to establish a status quo ante, we can try to equalize the relationship between the parties in the sense that one party doesn't end up with an advantage over another by means of corrupting our procedures.
Absolutely not, because
right.
The
so
language...
So there is nothing, I just want to be clear,
mm-hmm.
There is nothing, in your view, that the board could do in the most egregious case that the board thought was before it, other than, say, Congress, please help us out.
Your Honor, I think you shifted the verb tense slightly, because I think your initial question was to me saying, in this case, and so my response to you was, in this case, there's absolutely nothing that the board did to invoke any other statutory source of authority.
What other source of authority might be available?
Well, again,
to
I think that is a question for the board in the first instance. That could create a Chenery
what
issue.
What would you think?
Well, again, I don't think there
the
is
The way
one.
Your brief is written,
well,
all right,
yeah.
Be clear. As I read it, and I may have misread it, your point is that unless there's a statute 10Q saying the board is hereby authorized to impose attorney's fees, it lacks such authority statutorily, and necessarily it therefore lacks authority as a matter of its inherent power, period.
Well,
and
I-
you stop there.
Yes, I think, again, that's not just me. That is unbelievable, saying the standard the Supreme Court has set.
No, we're trying to be clear about
unbelievable. Okay, I'm sorry.
I thought Judge Williams' questions are trying to point out that unbelievable doesn't, at least I understood his questions, to ask whether you thought unbelievable went that far.
Well, I think unbelievable does say that attorney's fees are different. Shifting attorney's fees is different. And we've known since Alyeska and the Summit case that Congress doesn't hide attorney's fees shifting in mouse holes. That is a big deal.
At least in the Article III context.
Well, again, I would think even less so in the agency context.
Yes.
I would think it would be strange to think that it would. And I think, again, this court addressed that specific potential distinction in Unbelievable, too, because the dissent in Unbelievable made that argument, and the court made the point that I just made. It'd be even weirder to say it in the agency context. So, again, I think the answer to your question, Judge Rogers, is to say, I think the logic of Unbelievable and really of the Supreme Court is that you can't kind of, through conjuring up, through implications in very general provisions, find authorization for fee shifting. That's not the way our system works.
Well, let me go back, because I want to be clear about Fallbrook.
Okay.
The court there says the only question before the court on the petition for review is whether the board's, I'm quoting,
yep,
award of negotiation expenses was a clear abuse of discretion, citing
right.
Steelworkers.
Right.
Fallbrook argues that the board decision is wanting because it fails to take account of the totality of the circumstances is unsupported by law.
Right.
We reject that argument.
Right. And I think that is why, in response to our 20HA letter,
right,
we attach not only the opinion, but the briefs. And I think it is clear when it says unsupported by law, it was not actually making a broader authority point. It was simply saying it's unsupported in the board's law insofar as the board's case law about negotiating costs required X, Y, and Z, And in Fallbrook, they were saying it didn't meet X, Y, and Z, the board standard.
And this court says and has a rational basis in the law.
Right.
All right. You just think it's an application case, not an authority case.
I do, Your Honor. I do, Your Honor. I recognize there is some language in this court's opinion that seems to go broader than that. And I think then the question...
Well, when we talk about abuse of discretion, it means, you know, arbitrary, capricious, or contrary to law.
Well,
so, you know, there are several things going on.
Certainly, if this court wants to read its cases that way that's water under the bridge and we're never, you know, that's fine. The one thing I would say on bargaining costs is that we have a separate and independent argument apart from the authority argument, which is the award of all costs. And in that regard, I think it's quite felicitous that our case is here today along with the HTH case.
Why isn't it just premature, that issue?
Well, again, that is the question is, we are fine. If this court says this is premature,
right,
no problem, as long as it's clear that the standard that applies in the subsequent compliance proceeding is the standard that the board itself articulated in HTH, under which it says, and I'm quoting now from HTH, to guard against a speculative remedy, or a punitive remedy, to put it differently, we will require the union to provide detailed evidence of such expenditures at the compliance proceeding. That this is your point, that there's a subsequent compliance proceeding, along with evidence showing that they resulted from the respondents' unfair labor practices and why they would not otherwise have been incurred.
I think this is your argument to the board.
I'm sorry?
This is your argument on compliance.
Well, I understand, but the board
has
said...
We don't have to jump ahead.
In its briefing in this court, the board said, well, it's premature, and then in a subsequent proceeding, it says, we, the company, can try to show that these are not causally related. The burden is key. The burden makes it punitive. The union should have the burden of showing why, for instance, to go back to Judge Henderson's hypo from the previous case, somebody isn't getting double paid from their salary of sitting there in the negotiating table and elsewhere. That should be the union's burden. My only point,
isn't that, just as we were discussing in the other case, the type of thing that you would raise on a motion for consideration then?
Well, Your Honor, again, I think they have now said it is premature. We are just saying it's kind of strange for them to say it's too late. It should have been raised in the motion for reconsideration. And now you can't raise it now. We are just saying, please, we are 100% fine.
Agree with me you could have raised this on a motion for reconsideration?
You could have, but again, it's a little bit strange for them to be saying, you know, they have somehow waived it. They can no longer ever raise it. At the same time, they're saying to you, this is premature.
They're giving you another chance.
I'm sorry?
They're giving you another chance.
Well, yeah, okay. And so,
right.
and what we're saying is we're delighted.
Take it and run.
Let's just be clear that when we get that other chance, that it's the other chance under the current board standard.
But the point is the court doesn't have jurisdiction because you didn't raise it. It's the argument being made. So
well,
you
again,
have to make all your arguments. The board has given you this opportunity.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think we have two answers to that. First, again, I think by them saying, they don't actually say that you don't have jurisdiction in the sense that when they're saying that it's premature, that is actually inconsistent with saying that you don't have jurisdiction. And the second is, this seems to me, is allowing us to be responsible for bargaining costs that did not flow from an unfair labor practice would be clearly ultra-vires and punitive. In other words, that, it seems to me, would fall into the extraordinary circumstances exception to the extent that they are forcing us to pay, and in their words, all bargaining expenses from the first session in January 2008 to the last session in May 2009, every nickel. And there has been no factual finding that every single one of those flowed from an unfair labor practice. So again, I think that would be clearly even assuming they have the authority to award these as a general matter, to award all bargaining costs without qualification. And unless this court says something, what they're going to do in the compliance proceeding is hand us a bill, says, okay, here's the, you know, the guy spent 2 days, his salary, you have to pay 2% of his yearly salary or whatever. And the union has to show why they would not have incurred those costs but for the unfair labor practice, or else it's punitive.
Now, the board says that your client, never raised to the board that it lacked a statutory authority under 10C regarding reimbursement.
Right.
The, All right. And then in your response, you say, well, yes, we did. But when I look at what you referred to, it's just in a heading. There's no argument.
That is true.
The reference is to costs, which heretofore we've been talking about costs as attorney's fees.
We do specifically say bargaining costs in that heading.
And that's the last time it's mentioned.
That is true, Your Honor.
How does that comply with the board's rules?
I think perhaps the more important point is that the board then went on to actually assert authority to do it, to award bargaining costs.
No. It asserted authority, but you never challenged, says the board, its authority to impose that as a remedy.
Well,
and the only place you mentioned it to the board is in a heading.
Right.
And you had no argument.
Right. If you think
I'm just asking you, because you came back in your reply very strongly saying, no, we did raise it.
Right. And we did. You can query whether or not that was sufficient. But, factually, it is there.
It's not a query. It's in a heading. There's
right.
no argument.
Well, Your Honor, again, but what I would emphasize then
right.
is that the board did proceed to address that issue. If you look at page 3 of the board opinion.
The board imposed it. Then
right.
it was your obligation, was it not, to object?
Well, again, the ALJ imposed it.
Right.
Then we go to the board,
so
and we have this heading that includes
right.
specifically includes bargaining costs.
And
then
that's
the
last mention of bargaining
that's
costs.
That's fair. But I would say then what happens after that
yeah.
is the board issues a decision. The
right.
board specifically affirms we have authority to do this. And so I the point I would make is that where the board is actually making legal conclusions, it's one thing for the board to say, you know something, we're not going to address our legal authority because it's never been challenged, so we don't have to go there. But when the board affirmatively goes there, it seems like it would be undesirable to have a regime where this court then cannot review legal conclusions that the board actually made.
Where it's never challenged?
Well, if the
board, in a motion for reconsideration?
If the board doesn't ever go there,
but you can say you've done this, but you don't have any authority to do it.
Your Honor, again, with the record
why
is...
Why isn't that exactly the scheme that Congress had in mind?
Your Honor, again, I think what Congress had in mind was not necessarily the board making legal conclusions on allegedly unchallenged grounds that then were immune from judicial review. And again, let me just underscore...
No, it said, raise your objection to the board. Let's see what the board says about it. And the board might say, you're right.
Your Honor, again, all I can say is that it is in the heading. It was specifically addressed by the board. But again, just to be clear, we're talking there only about the authority on the bargaining cost side of the house. I mean, there's several different issues here, and I just want to make sure that we don't get them.
I thought that's what we were discussing.
We don't get them confused. Then there's the...
No one's getting them confused.
I'm sorry,
counsel.
I apologize. Maybe I'm getting...
All right. We've been talking about bargaining expenses.
Your Honor. Yes, but there's a different issue on bargaining expenses, which is the all bargaining
that's
expenses.
That's right.
And that is a different issue where the board itself says...
You said you'd be happy to get a chance to...
It's premature.
Right.
And let me underscore again, there is no procedural barrier that is put up in this case, unlike the HTH case where there was some colloquy on this, with respect to the inherent authority to award litigation costs. So I think what this case is really teeing up for the first time is the question whether the board has inherent authority that is separate and independent from any statute to award, to shift attorney's fees. And I think the answer to that fundamental question of administrative law is and has to be no.
Can I just, there's a passage in your reply brief where you respond to the board on Chambers.
Okay.
I'm looking at the top of page 16.
Okay.
Thus, the board's efforts to characterize the fee shifting here as remedial rather than punitive in nature fails utterly, citing footnote 15. And I guess I'm just not sure what that means.
Well, Your Honor, I think Chambers is somewhat of an ironic case for the board to be relying on, because it seems to me Chambers makes it crystal clear, and even the board's reading of Chambers here a few minutes ago, that what was at issue in Chambers and that was the remedial of a court's remedial authority to punish or to sanction the attorneys for misconduct, or the parties for misconduct in the courtroom. So it's not the underlying offense. In other words, I think opposing counsel, my friend, got up here and actually emphasized that it was not for the underlying offense. This case is Chambers on steroids, because in this case, the board is actually saying the bad faith exception for shifting attorney's fees is warranted because of the underlying unfair labor practices. They're saying your client didn't, you know, he didn't bargain in good faith. He showed up late for the meetings. He canceled the meetings. That is not the conduct underlying the sanction for which they are claiming inherent authority is not conduct, is not limited to conduct before the board in the litigation proceeding. And I think, Your Honor, you asked a question earlier, why did Chambers go off on whether this was punitive? It's because it had to be clear that it was imposing sanctions as a, because there was an Erie issue in right. Chambers. And it had to be litigation-related conduct to avoid the Erie issue, because if it was for the underlying breach of contract, then it would look a lot more substantive. It was remedial in order to make the other party whole, it would create a lot more Erie questions. That's, I think, the answer to your question, why Chambers went out of its way to say our bad faith attorney shifting is punitive, which, again, I think goes to underscore why even assuming that agencies could invoke inherent authority completely separate from their statutory authority, they don't fit into the Chambers box. It's a totally different box, and that's not what they're actually doing here. If you look at their order, the conduct that they are talking about is all the underlying unfair labor practice conduct. It is by no means limited to the conduct in the proceedings before the board.
So the board says the respondents accept only. You're familiar with that language.
In which context is the board saying this now, Your Honor?
This is in the second paragraph of its decision and order.
Okay.
Actually, it's the third paragraph.
Yes, I see that language, Your Honor, in front of me. So I think what the board is saying there is we are not accepting to the underlying unfair labor practices conduct, which is true. The exceptions we brought before the board related to the attorney's fees and to the bargaining costs.
Where does it say that?
The response is only to the order granted General Counsel's request that reimburse the union for all costs and expenses incurred in collective bargaining negotiations. So that's the negotiating costs. And it says, in addition, the respondents accept to the judge's order that they reimburse the board and charging party for, quote, all costs and expenses. And this, again, just goes to show how remarkable this is. In the investigation, preparation, and conduct mm-hmm. of these cases before the board and the courts. Mm-hmm. So those are the two. In other words, this even goes beyond attorney's fees to investigation costs and things that are absolutely unheard of in our system to be reimbursing a government agency for its investigation costs and its bargaining costs. Again, a similar kind of order came up in Unbelievable, and this court characterized this generally as shifting attorney's fees. But, you know, frankly, I think even looking at the kind of language they have here about investigation, preparation, and conduct just shows that they're going even further. I mean, if attorney's fees can't be recovered, then a fortiori, the cost of investigating for the thing that results in the litigation.
So the board operates under an annual appropriation.
Right.
The union has presumably an annual budget.
Right.
And everybody spent years wasting time because of the charge, the object of the charge brought by the general counsel. All right. And the way I read your brief, it really doesn't matter. There's nothing the board can do. I just want to be clear about that. So that even if an employer admits, doesn't challenge factual findings about a pattern of violations, unfair labor practices, for years and years and years and years, and it's just been a total waste of time, the board just has to swallow hard and say, well,
that's the way it is, and we're not going to be able to, our backlog will just grow, you know, 10, 20 times, because everybody will come in here and simply do what this employer did, frustrate our proceedings, and admit that it's done that, and admit it's done it deliberately. And I just want to be clear. Your position is they have no authority whatsoever.
2 points in response to that,
Your Honor. To award any costs, whether you call them bargaining expenses or attorney's fees.
2 points, Your Honor. First, even under the board's regime, these costs would not go back to the general counsel of the board. These would be paid to the U.S. Treasury.
No question about it. We all know how that works with OMB. So let's not get into the details of your negotiations with OMB. The Labor Department can handle that. But the point is, it sends a message to the people who are coming before the board that you can't wreck the system that Congress has created for the purpose of not only Section 7 rights, but Section 8 rights,
Your
as
Honor,
well, to protect the employer.
Congress can correct this with the stroke of a pen.
That's your point. There is nothing the board can do other than say to Congress, we need punitive authority.
So either, correct, either this court's decision in Unbelievable was wrong and the general authority
well,
to...
Well, we're stuck with it, but
well,
we
well,
have
I get that, but I'm saying that, in other words, one could have made an argument, and they did make an argument at the time of Unbelievable, that for exactly the policy reasons that Your Honor just articulated, you should read this kind of authority into some of the general interstices and the general remedial authority under Section 10C. This court rejected that. So they have gone now to an assertion of inherent authority. Our proposition is, and I agree with Your Honor, as things stand now, they don't have inherent authority that exists separate and apart from their statute. So if this is a problem, and Your Honor has articulated an entirely valid policy concern, the answer is, given the American rules strong rooting in our legal culture, they have to go to Congress. They can't. Unbelievable already held. It's not in the statute. Okay. So if it's not in the statute, then what they're saying is, well, they've now tried to come up with, it's inherent. It's in the clouds outside the statute. That won't work. So, again, I think as a result of Unbelievable, if they feel that there is a hole to be filled, they should go to Congress. Now, again, I would say one thing that's important. We are not saying that the agency has absolutely no way to discipline people and no implicit, no other authorities. I mean, Lord knows, the board has a lot of weapons in its quiver. The one weapon it doesn't have is litigation costs. It's
and
shifting.
What weapon? You don't want to tell me what weapon it has. With regard to what the board says is bad faith conduct at the bargaining table precluding any progress toward reaching agreement on numerous occasions, and it just goes on and on
well,
and
again,
on.
Again, you know, the board's authority is remedial. Typical.
Blatantly circumventing the bargaining process, disregarding their statutory bargaining obligations by unilaterally implementing numerous changes.
Right.
And then it cites its opinion in Frontier.
Right. Which actually, again, was a statutory opinion saying that it had this authority under 10C, a proposition that this court rejected in Unbelievable. And again, the board is a creature of statute. The board has from day one been deemed to be remedial. Maybe Your Honor is suggesting that, you know, when you have some bad apples who come before the board, they ought to be able to do some punishment.
Yeah,
how are you going to deter things?
The normal practice would be, and the cases are cited involving the SEC, you're barred from this area of endeavor.
Correct.
All right?
Correct.
Now, can the board bar your clients from interstate commerce?
We see no problem with the proposition that administrative agencies, as in the Touche-Ross case, the Chikosky case, the Polidorov case, can be deemed to have certain implicit authority to police their own processes. And in those cases that I just mentioned, I think Your Honor just mentioned, courts have upheld under agency's general rulemaking and adjudicatory.
I'm with you, counsel, but the point is the SEC cases, they bar you from practice in that field.
Right.
Can the board bar your client from engaging in interstate commerce because of its egregious conduct before the
board? I think that, again, Your Honor, that is not presented here.
I know, but I'm pressing you. You say the board has all these remedies.
Right. I think that would seem to me to cross the punitive remedial line.
Well,
again,
I would think
well,
you would.
Didn't the board do exactly that when it said Boeing couldn't move from Washington State to South Carolina?
Yes.
That's exactly what the board told
me. And I think that was a highly controversial decision. And again, I mean, I think...
Why did it do that?
Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the ins and outs of that case, but I'm just, in the background of everything we're talking about, we're going back to the earliest...
Was it because of egregious conduct over decades by the employer? Or was it because of the treatment of the union members and employees? I mean, I don't know why the board did it, but I'm just talking about in this case. This says, you know, abrogation of their settlement agreements, defiance of their legal obligations to bargain, refusal to resolve these cases short of trial, reliance on non-meritorious defenses that cause the general counsel and the union to expend resources needlessly and burden the board's processes unnecessarily.
I think you are raising some interesting questions.
But, I mean, I'm raising it only in the context of saying that the board has made a finding of bad faith in exceptional circumstances, and there still is nothing the board can do.
Well, it's certainly...
All right.
I don't know about nothing, but the one thing I can say it can't do is invoke extra statutory inherent authority akin to the authority of the Article III courts.
Although
that
you
is
do
the issue
acknowledge
before you.
It has inherent authority in some respects.
Again, I think then it depends what you mean by inherent authority. I think
what do you mean by it?
Well, what I mean is authority that does not derive from a statute. I think this is the point that we all have to be.
But you said the board had some inherent authority.
No. What this court has said, it has certainly used the word inherent authority. If you look at every single case in which that has ever been used, it has always been used as another way of referring to implicit statutory authority. That is exactly the point that Judge Pillard made in her recent dissent in the Ivy Sports case.
Pillard.
So, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Pillard,
excuse me. That Judge Pillard made in that case. So again, we are not saying the board does not have certain implicit forms of statutory authority to control its own processes. What we are saying is what Unbelievable said was such kind of implicit authority does not extend to fee shifting, and once you acknowledge that, you can't go outside the statutory realm to invoke inherent authority that exists independent, that is not implicit statutory authority, but is actually inherent authority that is extra statutory by definition. That is what this case is about.
If we rule in your favor, wouldn't we simply be saying, with all the other powers you may have, NRB, it doesn't include the redistribution of money. In other words, the fees, the costs, the maybe redistribution is the wrong word, it's loaded, but the one thing the board can't do is impose monetary remedies in the form of bargaining costs that aren't related to ULPs, attorney's fees, and anything else, fines, whatever they may.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's a good way of putting it.
All right.
There are no further questions.
Has any court taken that position, just so I'm clear?
I don't know that issue has ever been teed up as such. Again,
wanted to know if in your research you had come across something.
I assume
you would have cited it.
I have come across certainly many cases, and Your Honor is aware of many cases, saying that their authority is remedial, not punitive. I think once you start to getting into you must pay money, and it's remedial for the unfair labor practice. So once
the board does that when it orders back pay, front pay, reinstatement of employees, et cetera. And
right.
I think Judge Henderson is drawing a distinction, and I just want to understand.
I think she is.
I'm sure she is. And
I agree. I think I understood that to be implicit in the question. I think you were talking about you can't impose money not to compensate the underlying unfair labor practice, but really as a result of alleged misconduct. And if Congress wants to get litigation misconduct or bad faith, and if Congress wants to give the board that authority, it can give it, but that doesn't fit easily into the remedial punitive dichotomy that is the world that we live in here.
So where we've spoken of agencies having authority to protect the integrity of its processes for the purposes of policing the conduct of practitioners before.
Correct. That was not money. That was that case, I think the Polidorov case, the Tucheros case, that was about suspending a professional who practices before the agency for some period of time.
And the right to practice in the profession itself. If that's not monetary shifting.
Well, it isn't directly. I mean, it is an exercise of the agency's authority.
Well, I'm a stockbroker, and I can't function as a stockbroker for 5 years until I'm reinstated by the SEC.
Your Honor, again, I think Judge Henderson's line has a lot to recommend it that, you know, there are these cases, but put it this way, I think all the cases that I'm aware of, at least, are along the lines that Judge Henderson suggested, which are you can't practice. I'm not aware of anything that says, and you shall also remedy the harm you did on our process by reimbursing us for every day that you were standing before us being a clown. And again, I think that's somewhat interesting that you know, it's fallen into more that kind of injunctive, declaratory side rather than imposing fines and penalties. If there are no further questions.
Judge Rogers?
No, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning again. Barbara Sheehy for the National Labor Relations Board. I want to start with the sort of where the court finished on opposing counsel thing. And I would like to caution the court the idea that there could simply be a statement from the court that within the board's powers is not the, or within the board's remedial authority, is not the ability to redistribute, or for whatever, however the phrasing would be, the redistribution of money. Because it's not, I think in this case, you're talking two different, very, very different types of costs. You're talking about litigation expenses, which there's been a lot of discussion on how rooted in the American jurisprudence that is, but then you're also talking about the board's statutory authority under 10C to impose bargaining expenses as a remedial measure. So I would just caution the court, and I'd also say, and I think we sort of belabored the point, so I won't go there too much, is that the argument on the 10E that, frankly, it's not a preserved claim, that it was taken for granted that the board had the authority on bargaining costs. Certainly, we are in complete agreement that the issue of litigation expenses is entirely preserved and properly before the court. But just like the employer before, this employer did not properly preserve the authority of the board. If you read the brief goes strictly to whether or not the employer's conduct reached the threshold level of imposing bargaining expenses on this employer. I'm going to say we're in agreement with opposing counsel on the issue of Fallbrook. I was the attorney that handled Fallbrook, and I agree that the court there, I know for a fact that the employer in that case did not challenge the underlying authority of the board to act. That what was briefed in that case was whether or not, irrespective of, I think, how their brief read in terms of the authority of the board, I think it went to what opposing counsel said, which was whether or not under the board's precedent did their conduct reach the sufficiently egregious level. So that notwithstanding, so we certainly don't believe, unfortunately, that Fallbrook is dispositive on the issue of bargaining expenses should the court decide to reach that. But we would say, and I think Judge Henderson commented on this, that sub silentio, there is in that case certainly an endorsement from this court. There's very emphatic language on the board's remedial authority to issue bargaining expenses. So I'd encourage the court not just simply to say Fallbrook has no bearing, but there is language in that case that I think is very helpful in defending what the board sees as its remedial authority to impose bargaining costs. I wanted to speak now to Chambers, just to clarify what happened there. And I think it is relevant. I must have done a poor job trying to explain it before, so I'm going to take one more crack at it now that I have two times to be up here this morning. In that case, it was significant because of the Erie issue. It was significant to determine whether the conduct that was being sanctioned was the underlying claim or whether the conduct was in the litigation itself. Because if a finding of the latter would have meant that litigation expenses were properly awardable, because it wouldn't have been punitive. It would have been punitive if the sanctions were imposed because of the breach of contract claim, because you're piling on in that instance. And so I know we're all going to stumble over exactly what does it mean then to have it be the underlying conduct. And I would encourage the court to look at what the conduct was in Chambers. I said this before, and I'll just repeat it. In Chambers, the conduct was filing false and frivolous pleadings, attempting by other tactics of delay, oppression, harassment, and massive expense to reduce NASCO to exhausted compliance. And here you have the board, looking at Camelot's conduct, which wasn't simply the bad faith. I think that's a massive overstatement of what the board looked, a massive understatement rather, of what the board looked at for what the conduct was. The board ordered the exchanging of fees, the shifting of fees rather, for four reasons: the abrogation of the settlement agreements, defiance of legal obligation to bargain, refusal to resolve the 2009 cases short of litigation, and reliance on transparently non-meritorious defenses. And I think if you look at the reasons that the board imposed there and said your conduct is sufficiently bad faith that we're going to invoke the bad faith exception of the American rule, but that is remarkably similar to the conduct that was found by the Supreme Court in Chambers to not be related strictly to the underlying claim, but to the actual conduct of the litigation itself, to bring it outside the realm of punitive. So I would say that it would be worthwhile to look at what the specific conduct was in both cases when deciding whether or not the board's order is punitive. I'd also remind the court that the litigation costs, because I think there's been some perhaps overstatements of what the board actually imposed, the litigation costs against Camelot were limited to the 2009 cases. There were two sets of unfair labor practices. They were limited to, the litigation costs are limited to the 2009 cases, and that's specifically because, as I outlined before, what the board's order was, the abrogation of the settlement agreements. The facade of entering into settlement agreements with the implicit understanding that you're just going to walk away, those cases subsequent to that, those cases are the ones where the board ordered litigation expenses, not dating all the way back throughout all of the 2008 and 2009 issues. To be fair, the 2008 bargaining, so the bargaining expenses are dating back under the order to the 2008. That will go for the length of the bargaining. But the litigation expenses were limited to everything that happened when the employer repudiated the settlement agreements.
Is this case 33 CA 15781?
I'm sorry?
Is this what in the remedy C? Reimburse the NLRB and the union for all costs and expenses incurred in the investigation, preparation, conduct of case 33 CA 15781.
Yes, yes, I believe that's the 2009. Let me double check. I believe those are the 2009. I think we tried to make this point in the brief. Those are the 2009 cases. Let me just, before I definitively say that, 15781, yes, was the 2009 case.
All right, and then the next one, D, sweeps in all the cases.
That's 2008 and 2009. So, right, to be sure, the bargaining expenses date back from the time of the sham bargaining that the employer engaged in. Moving to the issue of the all costs, I did want to make a small point here, that the employer makes much of the fact that the board's order in HTH was far more specific than it was in this case, so therefore the board's order must be infirm here because they didn't tie the bargaining costs to the unfair labor practice. And I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding on what's being quoted when the board says in HTH the very specific evidence that it's requiring the union to come forward to. That was on a unique remedy that, in my knowledge, we haven't seen before. It wasn't the bargaining expenses as it related to sitting at the table. It was the bargaining costs, non-bargaining costs, rather, associated with the barring of the access of the employees in that case. When the court looks at the actual order itself in HTH, the very detailed language about insisting that the union come forward with very detailed evidence showing that any of the expenses it intends to recoup stem from the violations is not a bargaining expense order. That is part of the board's remedy of the unfair labor practice of the employer in that case from unilaterally barring two of the employees, union representatives, from entering the facility.
Why does that? I mean, I take it you're saying that on remand and the client's procedures, the company would have the burden of showing the absence of causal connection, right? You're saying that.
Well, no, what I'm saying is I think all you can read into the board,
no,
the difference.
I'm sorry. Get your either prediction or commitment as to what the board is going to do in compliance procedures. And what you're saying here would seem to be pointless unless you were essentially saying the burden will be on the company to show absence of causal relationship.
No, I don't think so. I think in a compliance proceeding, for instance, the union would have to come forward to show what cost it incurred in bargaining or in the HTH case, what cost
it. Okay, so you're agreeing with Mr. Landau's request that the union carry the burden in that process.
I think that's typically in compliance when the union is coming forward. Somebody has to produce, for negotiating expenses, for instance, somebody has to start the conversation, right, to say I'm entitled to $25,000.
Sometimes when it starts the conversation, other people end it.
That's right. Burden of coming forward versus distinguished from the burden of proof.
Certainly, no, but I think the burden is still on the union to show that.
You're saying counsel is wrong in citing what happened at HDH, but he's right in asking that the burden be placed on the union.
Absolutely, and I think he's wrong in making hay that the board made some error here. I think it was just an instruction to the parties because it was a different sort of remedy than you've seen. So they were reminding the union, we've not imposed something like this before, so FYI, here's what you need to do in compliance. But I don't think it's any different than an other typical compliance proceeding. I think it was reinforcing because it was a new order.
Okay. And the board does rely explicitly and exclusively on inherent authority. Is that right?
It does rely on its inherent authority, right, to police its proceedings, which I agree, and there's been a lot of conversation.
There's a lot that can fit within the concept of policing proceedings.
Absolutely right. And so I think we agree that the cases, and this is why the board in its brief sort of didn't really cite to the SEC cases or the FDA cases, because I agree that in the reply brief, I think is where you see the bulk of the argument, that those cases, and also relying on Pillard's dissent in Ivy Medical Center, that those are when the court is evaluating an administrative agency's invocation of inherent authority at a fundamental level, in terms of the very function of the agency, and it's like a jurisdictional question, or whether or not it has authority to regulate a particular industry in the FDA case. That in that circumstance, this court, I do think, has been, and other jurisdictions, don't speak to inherent authority. That's implicit in your statutory authority. But here, so I do agree that the way the board is using the term, the notion, inherent authority, is different than in those cases. The board here is not trying to assert itself in a jurisdictional fashion. Here you have the board outlining that at some point, it has to, at some basic level, it has to protect the integrity of its own process. That you can't function, even as a congressionally mandated body, you cannot function if parties before you behave in a manner that is at its fundamental level entirely inconsistent with basic decorum and basic ways that you behave before the agency. So it's not that the board is relying on an implicit statutory ability or at its fundamental level, like I said, to promulgate legislative rulemaking. What it's relying on is its ability to protect its own process and to ensure that it can carry out its congressionally mandated, its congressional mandate, that it can actually process the cases and that it can decide the cases and to just control its own process. So that's the inherent authority. So I completely agree that the notions of inherent authority are quite different, and the way the board is invoking it here is not in the same sense that you've seen the FDA invoke it to defend a regulatory measure, or the EPA when it defended, or any of the other types of administrative regulations that we've seen in the briefs.
So I understand in those other types of cases cited in the gray brief that there is someone before the agency whom the agency can cite and whose behavior the agency can directly affect. Here, what authority does the board have to protect the processes Congress intended it to carry out if it has no authority, inherent or otherwise?
And I guess that's where we part ways. I think the board views its authority differently, that it has its statutory authority to regulate the labor industry. And that
why aren't attorney's fees different? I'm trying to draw this line. You know, counsel says in his brief, and he's backed off his brief a little bit this morning, but basically he says you can't do this. You're not a court. You don't have any sort of inherent authority like a court. You're an agency. And unless Congress says in hyc verba that you can do something, agency, you cannot do it. And so even if the court doesn't go that far, the question is, where do you draw the line? For example, if the board were to issue an order telling the company it has to sell its business, you know, in 30 days, and it can never enter this business again because of the egregious way it behaved before the board, as distinct from some things that you're arguing under 10C, the board has been given the authority to do in terms of bargaining expenses. So has Congress signaled that attorney's fees are different?
I don't think so, no. And I think two ways that I'd like to address the question is, I think if you see the board do a patent overreach, like the example you have to liquidate your assets because of the way you behaved, there is a way to seek review on that, and the board couldn't defend. It would be under the patent overreach. This court could review that order. But on top of that, the notion that the court or that the board, I think I'd go back to many of the questions that you were asking opposing counsel, which is that there has to be some measure of ability, even in an administrative agency, to govern your own processes. And if it was simply a matter of there's no statutory authority, so that ends the inquiry, there would have been no reason for this court in Alwyn, or even in Unbelievable, but I think it was more powerful in Alwyn, to say that invocation of authority and inherent authority in awarding attorney's fees, that it's not obviously ultra vires. I think that if it was a simple matter of if you can show that there is no statutory authority, you cannot have inherent authority. If that was the case, I don't think we would have seen that footnote from the Alwyn court indicating that it's not obviously ultra vires to invoke an authority to govern your own processes where you have a very abusive party before you.
Can I ask you, do you see the NLRB as sui generis? I mean, if you can impose attorney's fees, why can't any agency?
I don't think that's a concern, and I say it because of this. The board has, and I'm not familiar with the enabling statutes of many of the other agencies, but the board is vested with the authority to regulate the processes in the labor industry. So when somebody's litigating before it.
Well, so does the securities industry. So does the drug industry. So does, I mean, you know, if you're authorized to award attorney's fees, why aren't they? And under this inherent authority argument.
And I don't know. I don't know whether if you could show that an administrative agency has the inherent authority. I don't know if there's a difference, for instance, and I wouldn't be able to speak to it, is there a difference in what the SEC does versus the board as it matters to attorney's fees? I mean, not just, you know, fundamentally, do they have a different function? So I wouldn't want to speak to that, but I think that I don't see that the board's authority here is unique to the board if it's drawing from an inherent authority to govern its process. Okay. Unless there are any other questions? I don't think I had anything else.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Landau, okay, why don't you take a couple minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief. I have three quick points I'd like to make. First, my friend admitted, in a sense, that this is not just
Chambers and the inherent authority of the Article III courts that they're seeking, but Chambers on steroids, because she actually quoted, and it's right here on, it's on page 6 of the NLRB, the board's decision, appendix page 6, that specifically says, in this proceeding, as in the above cases, we find ample proof that respondents here display bad faith both in their underlying unlawful conduct and in their conduct related to the litigation. So there can be no question here, in sharp contrast to Chambers, that the shifting of attorney's fees and the inherent authority invoked was not just the inherent authority invoked to police the proceedings, but to actually sanction the underlying conduct. So again, that is right there in the board's order that's before you. So at a minimum, this thing cannot be approved as an application of Chambers. Second quick point I wanted to make, I think with respect to the burden on the bargaining costs in the compliance proceedings, that was a very interesting colloquy where I understood counsel basically to concede that the burden should be on the union. I just want to underscore that that is certainly different than what counsel said on pages 16 and 51 of the brief, where they said if the company believes that the award of bargaining costs should be limited, it is free to put forth supporting evidence. That was on 16. And the same thing on 51. Accordingly, to the extent that the company seeks to limit liability, it can bring forth evidence and argument.
Well, I thought the argument is that somebody's got to take the first step. The union says we spent $100,000. The company says that's crazy. How much do you pay your attorneys? No, How much do you pay your secretaries? You know, that's ridiculous. You ought to cut that in half.
No, but
so
I think the
board has, the employer comes forward to challenge what the union says.
No, but I think this is where the union has I go back to HCH then.
But
the
board. What does the union do after it says we spent $100,000 and here are employee vouchers and our payroll records?
We're going down to bargaining costs. And I think what the union has to do is say, look, we're charging you for, you know, 5 nights at this hotel.
All I'm getting at is, why are we getting into the nitty-gritty of this? This is a board proceeding. They know how to run it. This is standard operating procedure. And, you know, it's premature for us to get in. If you're not properly treated there, you can come back.
Your Honor, I guess I just wanted to underscore that what the board is saying here would seem to be punitive, and I don't want the board to be able to turn around in the compliance proceeding and say, you didn't object to that in the D.C. Circuit, so now, guess what? It's res judicata, and you lost your ability. Just to make it very clear that
it's clear you object.
Okay, perfect. Then I have done my job on that score. The last final, just very brief point is, again, I think it was very telling that when counsel was up here a moment ago talking about what is the best authority that they have for the proposition that the board or any agency has inherent authority that is completely separate and apart from their statute. The best that they could say was, well, the court dropped a footnote in Unbelievable, leaving that issue open, and then the court subsequently in Alwyn by Judge, in opinion authored by Judge Wall for the court, also said it's not obviously ultra vires, again in a footnote. But whereas on the other side of the ledger, we have dozens of cases from the Supreme Court and this court saying that agencies are creatures of statute.
But you have no case that makes this case. You admitted to me when I asked you that question, what's your best case? Has any other court decided this? And you said no.
Well, this is the first time that an agency has ever invoked inherent extra statutory authority to award attorney's fees. There is no case that specifically addressed that issue, but there's lots of cases saying that's because they don't have inherent extra statutory authority at all. So
to do anything.
To do anything.
Even though you acknowledge that they have inherent authority in some respects.
Well, you know, again, I hope I have been 100% clear. The terminology gets confusing here. And again, I think this court and others have used sometimes the terminology of inherent authority when, in fact, they are referring to implicit statutory authority that is contained within a broad grant of authority. That's the only point I'm trying to underscore.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.